I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thomas Frank is our guest this hour. Thomas, of course, is the author of the bestseller What's the Matter with Kansas? And in that book, he takes on the Republicans, who at one point, he said, bear primary responsibility for our modern plutocracy, launched us on our modern era of tax cutting and wage suppressing. But this book takes on the Democrats. Listen Liberal is the name of his book, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas is the author of Pity the Billionaire, The Wrecking Crew. He's a former columnist for the Wall Street Journal and for Harper's. He's a founding editor of Baffler, and the book takes on so much. Obviously, one of the big issues of this time in which we live is this huge time of inequality. And, you know, he asks why it is that the Democrats really haven't addressed this. Here's something perhaps controversial he has said in his book. The current leaders of the Democratic Party know their form of liberalism is somehow related to the good fortune of the top 1%. Inequality, in other words, is a reflection of who they are. It goes to the very heart of their self-understanding. So, we got a lot to talk about this hour. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Thomas Frank is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Thomas Frank, hello. Thanks very much.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good. Welcome to the working class city of Milwaukee. We go beyond Milwaukee, but that's where we are.
Right now. I have to say, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And I've often thought, I think that you're spot on with so much of your analysis, but I just wish people, you know, in government and in the media would come to places like Wisconsin or come to places like Milwaukee and find out what really is going on in this country. It amazes me how blind people are to how so many people are struggling. So many people are struggling, and nobody's helping them.
I know it. And look, it's a cliche to talk about, you know, the people on the two coasts and the flyover country in between. And I used to have a lot of fun, you know, mocking that cliche, like in What's the Matter with Kansas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at a certain level, it's kind of true. I mean, I live in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. these days, and this is one of the most prosperous cities in America. And the kind of people that read the Washington Post and the New York Times tend to be very satisfied, very contented people, and they look around them at the world and they can't understand why all these people in the Midwest are so upset, why they're so voting for these outrageous candidates. It doesn't make any sense to them. In their world, everything works. Mm-hmm. God's in his heaven. All's right with the world, you know.
Let's talk about why this happened and how this happened. You have this, and I want to start with FDR, if you don't mind, because you remind us of who he had in his cabinet. He drew people from all over the country, and you know, this some of the brain trust was from Harvard and Yale and those kinds of places, but they were also from Iowa and Utah and people who Harry Truman, who didn't have college educations.
Yeah, you're talking about my heroes here.
Yeah, and now it's all Harvard and Yale and this tiny little world, and they all talk to each other, and they've all reached the top, and aren't we great?
That's exactly right. I mean, the only reason, I mean, let me just take a step back here. So Listen Liberal, this book that I've written, is a study of, you know, contemporary liberalism, and my hypothesis, which I think bears out, is that what we have today is a liberalism of the rich. It's a liberalism of the professional class. And in which the Democratic Party, by the way, is quite open about this, that the professional class is its number one constituency. And if you look at recent Democratic leaders, Barack Obama, the Clintons, that sort of thing, they tend to be drawn from this class, and they tend to be advised by people from this class. And you look at Barack Obama's cabinet and his inner circle of advisors, and the Washington Post, by the way, does this all the time, and they're always very they're just taken aback at how awesome his inner circle of advisors are, the amazing sort of academic credentials that he has assembled around himself. You know, but when I say that, I don't just mean these are people that went to college or these are people that went to Ivy League colleges. These are people that went to Harvard,
right?
One college in particular, or some of them went to Oxford for graduate school, Rhodes Scholars, right? And it's there, by and large, that is the group that is, it's very, very concentrated little group of experts in his cabinet and advising him. I mean, for God's sakes, he had the former president of Harvard as his first, you know, Larry Summers, the man who is essentially running the economy in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. And you look at this amazing assemblage of credentials and of sort of status, and you wonder, you know, these people are so awesome. Why is it that, you know, inequality is continuing to grow? Wages never go anywhere. You know, the working class is really hurting. Well, basically, to ask the question is to answer it, because people like that don't really, you know, they aren't really concerned about such things. So essentially, you look at the era of Obama, and it's, you know, this great era of, you know, of geniuses and people with fantastic credentials, but it's a meritocracy of failure. These are people that really didn't improve a whole lot over the George W. Bush administration. So that was where I started with Listen Liberal. But then I said to myself, well, there must be a time when expertise in government worked, right? Because I believe that government agencies should be run by people that know what they're doing. That makes that seems like common sense to me. But it's certainly not happening now. So I thought about it. And when did this sort of this strategy of governing work? And one time when it did, the sort of golden age of expertise in government is the Roosevelt administration, as you mentioned. They called it the Brain Trust. And these were people who were massively effective at running the government and running the American economy. But if you look at who Roosevelt chose to advise him, Roosevelt himself was a Harvard man, but that's not who he chose to advise him. He had some people from Harvard, but by and large, he took people from all walks of life, all parts of the country, people with all sorts of different credentials. They were very intelligent mm-hmm. people, and they knew what they were doing, but they weren't all representative of this one tiny little sliver of American life. You mentioned some of – I mean, if you look back over who was in the Roosevelt cabinet, it's fascinating. Like the man that he put in charge of his bailout – bailout agency. You know, they bailed out banks back then as well as this time around. But the guy that was doing it sure wasn't a Wall Street guy. He was, you know, it was the opposite. He chose a small town banker from Texas. I mean, this guy who just could not stand Wall Street. Mm-hmm. The man he chose to run the Federal Reserve was a small town banker from Utah. You mentioned Harry Truman, who was his vice president, was the last president we ever had who did not go to college. One of Roosevelt's attorney generals, a brilliant man, Robert Jackson. He was the prosecutor at Nuremberg. That was after Roosevelt died, but he was later on the Supreme Court, was a lawyer who did not have a law degree. And so on, right down the line. These were geniuses, but drawn from all over America and all sorts of different walks of life in the sort of classic American, you know, that's the kind of nation we used to be. The brilliant people came from all over. But when you talk to the professional class, they're like, you know, they know where genius resides, and it resides at the number one institutions, the ones with the highest SAT scores,
right?
You know, the most prestigious, and hence you have the Obama administration, and hence you have the Clinton administration, and hence you will have the Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. administration.
So you have, and if nobody, they still don't quite get what the recession did to people who lost their homes, who've lost their wages, who are still struggling. So how did it happen that we get with Obama, who's in charge of this stimulus program and figuring out what to do with the banks, and he, as you write, continues the policies of the crude and tasteless Bush administration, bank yeah. bailouts yeah. proceeded as before, and we get people like Geithner, Bernanke, Larry Summers from Wall Street, many of them. What about the people who've lost their homes? What about the small bankers? What about the problem that affected millions of Americans?
Well, look, you know, I'm going to be blunt here, you know, because you have to sort of simplify to understand this thing. But whenever there was a choice to be made between Wall Street and average Americans or homeowners or Main Street or however you want to put it, whenever there was a choice to be made, the Obama team chose Wall Street. And this is, you know, right down the line. But this is typical of the kind of Democrats that I'm describing. You know, they have a fondness for Wall Street that's often difficult for people to understand, because we think of the Democrats as the party of working people. We think of that sort of Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson Democratic Party. You know, this is the party of the middle class. This is the party that is supposed to be this great defender of workers, that sort of thing. But our modern Democrats really aren't. They persistently choose a different group whenever they have to make a choice. And there's many examples of this from the Obama administration, and there's many examples of it from the Bill Clinton administration. And what's funny about, and I could, we can talk about those in a minute if you want, but let me bring it back to where we are today in Washington, D.C., the city that I live in, where you have commentators and, you know, newspaper people and stuff like this who say, you know, how come the rest of the country thinks this economy is so awful? Don't they see?
Right.
Look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's going up and up and up. It's doing so well. You know, the jobs are growing all over the place. You know, unemployment is way down. Look at the numbers. You know, if you just look at the dashboard of the economy, you can see that it's doing really well. But I think average people understand that something changed permanently in the last recession. And that their, you know, the lives that they had in, you know, before that recession are going way back to the 90s. Those lives are never coming back. And they can see that the middle class in this country is actually diminishing now, mm-hmm. which is a shocking thing. Imagine if, you know, something like that had happened in the 60s or the 1970s. You had newspaper headlines saying the middle class is shrinking in America. That would have been unthinkable. But the rest of the country knows that that's happening, and they can see that, you know, that wages are going nowhere, and they can see what's happening to young people right out of college. And that stuff is largely invisible to our Democrats here in Washington, D.C., who are very, frankly, very pleased with how they've managed the economy and think that they deserve congratulations. You know, not mm-hmm. accusation.
And are being told, as you remind us in the Clinton chapters of your book, that, well, we have to accept the world has changed. We have globalization now. You need to get a really good education. Knowledge is power.
Yeah,
you need to go to the best school.
Yeah.
What about
I got one of those, by the way.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't go on to college, and a lot of people used to have family supporting jobs, et cetera. So is it just sort of a collective shrug? This is the way things are now, and our campaigns are fueled by Wall Street, so there's nothing we can do? Or what could Democrats do?
Wait, they say there's nothing we can do. They say this all the time. This is one of the big Hillary Clinton campaign statements when she opened her campaign, is that we're not ever going back to that economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to happen.
Right.
And they're very blasé about it. That's never coming back, they say. Now, what do they mean when they say that? Well, let me put it this way. The kind of Democrats that I'm describing in Listen Liberal, our modern day liberalism, sees every economic problem as an educational problem. Whatever the problem is, you could make something up, and they say, well, the answer to that is obviously people need to spend more time in school, and this is wrong in all sorts of ways. We can disprove it in, you know, there's facts out there that, you know, people who went to college in the last downturn actually did more poorly than people who didn't go to college. All sorts of ways that you can disprove it, but. And I mean, we can talk about my own personal experience. I'm one of these guys that went out and got a PhD, you know, and then discovers that there's no jobs for PhDs
right.
anymore. You know, there's a million ways you can disprove it. But the kind of Democrats I'm describing, for them, it is not susceptible to sort of disproof. It's not something that is possible to be disproved any more than, say, creationism is for a certain kind of you know, a certain kind of fundamentalist. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just something that they absolutely believe in. And one of the upshots of believing that everything is an educational every economic problem is really an educational problem is that it pushes the blame for every economic problem back onto the victim, his or herself. So you say, well, look, you know, there's no good jobs out there anymore. And they're like, oh, yeah, there is. You just didn't go to the right school, or
mm-hmm.
you just didn't stay in college long enough. Or maybe you did go to college, but you studied the wrong subject, you know, or maybe you went to the wrong college. Maybe you didn't go to a good school, you know. Anyhow, it endlessly pushes the blame back onto the individual. And as you mentioned, at the end of the day, you know, only a small percentage of the American public is ever going to be able to go to college. You know, 20 or 30% is going to be able to graduate, have a college degree. And as we've all heard the stories about these kids now, you know, who've borrowed tens of thousands of dollars, Hugo, and then they come out and they're facing the gig economy where it's impossible to make a living, much less make a living to pay off $100,000 student loan burden. I mean, don't tell me that college is the answer to all of these problems, but that's always the answer. They always fall back on that, you know, rather than actually talking about what really ails us and what we could do about that.
Well, what can we do about it? What can we do to make sure people have enough money to live?
Yeah. Can I keep going down this vein for a second before
I
answer
ahead.
That?
All right,
because, I mean,
yeah.
I want to impress upon your listeners this fact that you can do something about inequality, okay? One of the things that the kind of Democrats that I'm describing believe that inequality is basically this is like the, you know, the harmonies of the planets of the universe. There's nothing you can do. This is just the waves of history, you know. And they say, you know, there's nothing you can do about globalization. There's nothing you can do about technology. These things will just, they're having these effects, and there's nothing we can do to save people. And it's completely, completely false. Okay? Technology, trade, globalization, these are all human contrivances. These are all things invented by humans. Every economic relationship is ultimately a political relationship, and we can arrange it in a democracy, that is. We can arrange it however we want. And when they tell us that there's nothing we can do about globalization, as though it were the hand of God, you know, reaching down into human affairs to destroy one class of Americans and enrich another class of Americans, is just it's just the worst kind of cynicism and hypocrisy. And by the way, Democrats say it all the time. So do Republicans. But it's for Democrats, it has a special kind of guilty conscience that goes along with it, because they know that they're the ones who are responsible for our modern era of free trade, going back to NAFTA and then all the free trade treaties that were passed under President Clinton, and then going up to the present with Barack Obama trying to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed. Mm-hmm. Now, what can be done about it? Which is where you started. Well, I would say the first thing is look at these. When you talk about globalization, globalization has hurt a lot of people, but globalization is not the hand of God. Globalization comes to us, you know, is filtered to us, or comes, you know, comes into our lives via trade deals preeminently. There's other ways, you know, that it comes. There's other ways that it affects us, but the main one is these trade deals, and the trade deals are not written by God. They're written by, and this is going to be a shock to you, they're written by lobbyists. And those lobbyists write those trade deals the way that they do in order to benefit certain classes of Americans and in order to harm other classes of Americans. You know, so you take a treaty like NAFTA, you know, it's not globalization. It's 2,000 pages long. It's not free trade. You know, we already, tariffs with Mexico were already very low before NAFTA happened. What NAFTA did is it protects American property rights, the property rights of American business owners, if they want to relocate a factory into Mexico. And all the free trade treaties that followed that, I mean, they call them free trade treaties, but tariffs are very low, you know, across mm-hmm. the board. That's what they're about. They're about protecting the rights of certain kinds of Americans and effectively injuring other categories of Americans. And one of the things that I learned when I was writing Listen Liberal is that you could write a trade deal to benefit any class of Americans and to injure any other class of Americans. They don't have to be written. It's not like this is, you know, as I said, it's not the hand of the Almighty saying, here's how globalization unfolds. It could happen any way you wanted it to. I mean, you could. I have a friend here, an economist friend here in Washington, that has described how you would write a trade deal that would be very, very, very good for blue-collar workers here in America and really, really, really bad for members of the professional class. It would be easy to do, but it's No one ever talks about that kind of globalization, right? That's just not in the cards.
Thomas, we need to pause for a moment and we'll return. And we have a ton of people who want to speak with you. Thomas Frank is our guest this hour. He has a new book. He is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, which received so much attention. And this one is getting attention, too. Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? We're talking about the Obama administration, the Clinton administration. Actually, he's done a very careful examination of all the Democrats since the 1970s. Whatever happened to this, we're helping the working people, we're aligned with you. The Democratic Party rises and falls, as does the working class. What has happened to the Democratic Party being funded in many ways by the upper 10% and this professional kind of East Coast establishment taking over the top positions in the Democratic Party? Inequality. Nobody, Democrats, are not taking on the issue of inequality. A few are, and we'll mention those few as we continue. It obviously has become a campaign issue for the Democrats, probably thanks to, not probably, because of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. It's front and center, but we'll see what happens in the coming years. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you momentarily. Facebook, leave your messages there. We can read some of them on the air as the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thomas Frank is with us now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Let's go to Ruth in Madison for our first call for you. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say that under when Wisconsin was under socialism from the Depression until about the 1960s, Wisconsin prospered. And it was the Democratic Party that came into the labor unions and wooed the rank and file away from the Socialist Party to the Democratic Party with the promise that capitalism was a better way to go, because with capitalism we would have such prosperity and such sharing of wealth that there would be education that was free, there would be leisure time, and a lot of people drank that Kool-Aid. But we've never had capitalism, because at the very basis of our economy, the farm economy, has never paid enough money so that the applicants for the jobs are lined up out the door, which is how you said you would know when you're paid enough under capitalism, is that there would be people waiting to do that job. And that's never been true. Under this form of greedism, the people at the base of our economy aren't even as prosperous as a slave would be, because they don't get enough for housing, clothing, food, and some medication.
Thomas.
Well, I have to say, I love being on the radio in Wisconsin.
Well, come on over again.
I know. I do love your state. And I mean, let me just say that the relationship of the of organized labor to the Democratic Party is, it's one of the, you know, real flashpoints. If you ever talk to rank and file union people, or, and it sounds like the caller has, if you ever talk to the leadership of the unions there, you know, these are some of the most loyal Democrats out there. And they, you know, they, every 4 years, they turn over their treasury to the Democratic Party, and the rank and file gets out there and works and works and works to get Democrats elected. And they do phone banks, and they drive people to the polls, and they go door to door, and they really work. And then they present the Democrats, you know, they say, well, here's our issue this year. Here's our one issue. And with Obama, it was, you remember this? It was card check. They called it the Employee Free Choice Act. It would have made it much easier to form a union in America. Right now, as you probably know, Kathleen, it's very hard to organize a union in any workplace in America. And that's one of the reasons that inequality is out of control in this country, is because organized labor is dying. So organized labor says to Obama, you know, here's our one, you know, our one point, that, or one thing that we want to get past this year. They have just worked their tails off for this guy. And he's like, oh, you know, I don't think I'm going to do anything on that. I'm going to let that go. And the Clinton did exactly the same thing. Only Clinton was Clinton. It was a point of pride with him to be seen as, you know, insulting organized labor. And so that's when he got NAFTA passed. He did it to prove to the public that he wasn't, that he could stand up to his own, his party's own, greatest ally, historically speaking. But it's funny when you think about it, because NAFTA wasn't just an insult to organized labor. It actually injured them. You know, it actually did them material harm. And that's a Democrat, by the way, that did that. Mm.
And Republicans in this state and in others, as you well know, were smart enough to
of course, they're much worse.
The allegiance between Democrats and unions, and destroyed the public unions and private unions in this state.
Well, that's the genius of American politics, I should say, it's kind of the evil genius, is that the Democrats remain loyal. Union members remain loyal Democrats because they're so afraid of the Republican Party. And there's lots of elements of the Democratic coalition that are, they don't get listened to, right? There's only one part of the Democratic coalition that the party really listens to, and that's the professional class. They get what they want, right? They're very happy with the Democratic Party. It's like, it's speaking their language. The Democrats' issues are their issues. It's like they couldn't ask for a better political party. But, people like organized labor and a lot of different minority groups are terrified. They stay with the Democrats not because they think the Democrats deliver really well, but because they're terrified of the other side. And so they're what the political scientists call captured constituencies. And this is people like me, by the way, liberals, right? Because we're more afraid of the Scott Walkers of the world than we are hopeful about the Hillary Clintons of the world.
Ruth,
and
thanks.
So we're stuck,
Thanks for
we
the
got
call.
No when the Clinton types say, people like me have nowhere else to go. They're right.
Bob in Baraboo, hi.
Hey, Mr. Frank. First of all, thank you. Big fan of your writing and research. Very important to the country. I'm one of the founders of Fighting Bob Fest. I was one of the guys who invited Bernie Sanders to come to the state initially before anybody knew who he was. I went to one of those fancy colleges out east. Grew up here in Wisconsin, largely in a dairy farm. So I kind of bridge the gap, as it were, and can kind of see both sides. My school, probably 90% of the students, most of the C students mostly, went on to work for Wall Street. I think this is more about clubs and cliques who hold certain kind of unquestioned assumptions about their origins and their destinies.
That's exactly right.
Unquestioned assumptions revolve around their own education. I mean, this is about education, but the problem is not what you might think. The problem with education has become that it's become a means to sort of better obfuscation and means of manipulation of the folks who, don't know the big words but are otherwise largely pretty intelligent folks. And and so education in that professional class has sort of created its own sort of machinery of obfuscation and kind of barriers to entry. I mean,
well, there you go. You just hit it. That's exactly right. You just answered the question. Barriers to entry. That's what the professional class, that's what defines the professions, is they're legally protected. This is sort of life's officer corps. You have to have an advanced degree to be part of the professional class. You have to be certified in this way and that. Not just anybody can walk into a courtroom and start practicing law. These are all protected occupations, and they have barriers to entry. And often the barriers to entry are invented, or you take something like the economics profession, by the way, and this is a profession that has been wrong about nearly everything, but that doesn't stop them because they are able to define who is an economist and who isn't. And to be an economist, it's not just that you study certain subjects, it's that you agree with them right down the line. Every profession, I'm getting away from the point here, but every profession has an ideology. Let me get back to the main point, which is that liberalism as an expression of the professional class is all about in-groups and out-groups, okay, just like professionalism itself. So when the kind of people who are in the Obama administration and they, like Obama went to Columbia and then Harvard Law School and, all of the sort of people there who revere expertise, revere orthodoxy, they look at Wall Street and they see their peers. They see members of the what they like to call the creative class, people just like them. These aren't adversaries. You know, these are classmates. These are people with advanced degrees writing complex financial securities, derivative securities. These are people doing admirable work, plucking wealth from thin air. And so they'll say, and I have many, many, many examples in Listen Liberal of Obama team members talking about Wall Street as though these were, you know, intimate friends of theirs. But there's just an example that came out the other day. A great reporter who works for ProPublica called Jesse Eisinger got all of these Securities and Exchange Commission emails about why they weren't going to prosecute one of the big Wall Street firms. I forget which one. But he somehow got his hands on all these emails. And one of the top brass at the SEC said basically, these are good people that made just one mistake. Yeah, so they don't. So nothing ever happens to these guys. Okay, this is one of the most remarkable parts of the Obama administration story, that you've got obvious fraud on the face of it all through the last decade. Right? They called them liar's loans, for God's sakes. This, and they packaged this stuff up and sold it all over the world and brought the world economy to its knees. This is a, you know, this is a terrible, this is an unbelievable thing that happened. And nobody got prosecuted at the top of these Wall Street banks. Hell, nobody even got fired. You know, and these are people who, you know, the government bailed these institutions out. But at the bottom, right, if you lied on a mortgage application, the FBI is very zealous, you know, rounding these people up and throwing the book at them. People at the bottom, right? But people at the top who are members in good standing of the professional class, advanced degrees, writing derivative securities, these are the people that Democratic Party theory tells us we have to genuflect before.
And how much do you attribute, you talk about the amount of money that Obama received from Wall Street more than the Republicans, which is contrary to common
wisdom. By the way, that's a remarkable
wisdom.
Thing. Yeah. So it's the first time that ever happened.
Right. So do you attribute this cozy relationship with Wall Street and this lack of regulation and taking people to task into jail for what they did to the money contributions that are coming in, or is it more than that?
It's more than that. So the Democrats' love affair with the professional class goes back to the 70s, so well before the modern era of money in politics. It starts in the late 60s and early 70s when, you know, the country was coming apart over the Vietnam War. And at the Democrats had a commission. They decided to reform the Democratic Party to get a new constituency for liberalism. And they decided to remove organized labor from its sort of structural position in the Democratic Party and to reach out instead to this group that we're talking about, affluent white-collar professionals. And this is in the early 70s. People remember this was one of the big themes of the election of 1972 when the Democratic candidate was George McGovern. It was a big failure, but that doesn't mean that they gave up on it. They kept trying and they kept pushing, and now it's kind of a success for them. But I think that the money, I mean, because we are talking about a very affluent group here, the money is a big part of the story, but I think the ideology of it comes first. And the Democrats developed a whole ideology of the professional class, or you could say the other way around. The professional class had an ideology and it swallowed the Democratic Party, you know, the sort of ideology of the post-industrial economy with this knowledge workers and wired workers who were going to inherit the earth, and people who worked with their hands and worked in factories were going to be left behind like farmers were in the 19th century. And so the Democrats very consciously in the 70s aligned themselves with the group that they believed to be the winners in the new economic era. And that, by the way, that's very important, the winners. Okay, this is traditionally the party of working people and the middle class. And all of a sudden they've decided, well, you know, the winners are actually better people. They have better taste. They have better politics. They're just more admirable all around than working class people. And that's who they are to this day. You know, look, in the old days, you know, in the like Roosevelt, Truman era, right up into the 1990s, you know, Democrats were always out fundraised by Republicans, always. You know, if you go back to the Roosevelt era, it was, you know, it was a wipeout. Republicans had tons more money than Democrats did, even though the president was a Democrat. But it didn't matter because Democrats had the, you know, the middle class, the working class with them. They had the numbers, and Roosevelt won four times in a row. You know, it was a what I'm saying is, and by the way, Bernie Sanders has reminded us of this. You don't have to be the candidate of money in order to win. in this country. Mm-hmm. There's ways to do it. There's other ways to do it. But the Democrats have chosen a different path. They've chosen to reach out to this very affluent group, the sort of upper 10% of the income distribution. And by the way, when I say 10%, I mean to contrast that with the 1% that Democrats themselves always talk about, you know, the Koch brothers and all this sort of thing. Well, look, they themselves have aligned with the top 10%. And this is a group that has done very well in our modern sort of state of inequality. As this country comes apart, the Democrats' main constituency of affluent professionals has done very well. They are a mass constituency for inequality. They like inequality.
Mm. Thomas Frank is our guest. The book is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. More phone calls in a moment. Bob, thank you for yours. 800-486-8655 is the number. You can leave your comments on our Facebook page as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls in a moment. Have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren changed the nature, the description of the Democratic Party you've given us so far? Would you say, Thomas?
Well, Bernie Sanders is a, you know, it's funny that he called himself a socialist up until fairly recently. You know, he only joined the Democratic Party in order to run for president, but in some ways really represents who their, you know, their true tradition, the sort of Roosevelt tradition. And I think that's one of the reasons that party insiders reacted so negatively against him, almost as though they were allergic to him and to what he was saying, because he represented, you know, a sort of guilty conscience to them. You know, this is it's the return of the repressed, right? This is who they used to be, the sort of Bernie Sanders kind of party. I think what he did was very, very healthy for the party, but I don't think that Hillary Clinton will, you know, he pushed her to adopt a lot of his positions. I think that is going to be very short-lived. Hillary Clinton is an interesting person, but she is temperamentally, she's one of the when you talk about Wall Street Democrats, and I'm not saying this in an insulting way, she's one of them. She understands the sort of global financial industry as a very good thing. And I don't, you know, this is how I see her politics, how I read Hillary Clinton. Maybe I will be pleasantly surprised and she'll completely do an about face. But I think that she is temperamentally, if not ideologically, given to the kind of professional class politics that I'm describing here.
Let's go to Paul in Slinger. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good afternoon. The intractable problem is that if you take the top 4,000 U.S. corporations, now they have become global corporations. They sell, in most instances, the more of their sales are overseas in EU or in Asia than the United States. And the stocks are held by either retirement funds or pension funds or wealthy individuals across the globe. And these corporations, to remain competitive, have to go build their manufacturing and distribution centers where the market is and where labor rates are globally competitive. So, and they're even they're domiciling in other countries around the world. So the corporate leadership and the development people in these corporations to remain competitive with foreign competitors. They have to go with the flow here in manufacturing overseas, selling overseas. So the United States, a young guy coming out of, or gal coming out of school today, whether your high school or advanced degree, is going to be offered a job in Germany or Portugal or wherever they're building, have a plant where they need this expertise. So how do you solve that problem? I mean,
okay, let's get an answer.
Yeah, you're describing a global race to the bottom, and I would say that's a race that nobody is going to win, you know. And to say that you know, that one of the things that, by the way, this is not really what I write about in Listen Liberal. This is sort of a subject that I used to write about back in the old days, but the kind of corporations that the caller is describing will basically say anything to rationalize their profit making. They'll say, oh, we have to do it to remain competitive. Come on. There's always more than meets the eye. You know, if you look more closely, you'll always discover that there's a million other, you know, steps that they could take.
I'm wondering how we get, because I do think that there's this incredible disconnect for the most part between those who have a whole lot, who live in gated communities, who have people at their beck and call. People treat people who are very wealthy differently. They're asked to do all kinds of things, and they give to boards and sit on boards and make things happen. It seems to me as though we're lacking from this feeling of empathy in this country, of walking a mile in somebody else's shoes who isn't doing as well. And I'm wondering how it is that politics can get a sense of that. Do you think that that's gone, Thomas? And what do you do about understanding somebody else's plight and putting it front and center?
I don't think that's gone. I think people talk about it all the time. Liberalism is, I mean, one of the attractions of liberalism is this sense of virtue that liberals carry around with them, this sense of righteousness. And I live among liberals, and I know, I feel this firsthand. And I one of the episodes that I describe in Listen Liberal is when I go to a Clinton Foundation event in New York City. And this was Hillary Clinton was at the time that she was part of the Clinton Foundation. This is before she was running for president. And they brought in all of these women from the third world to talk about their life stories. And then there were also these women who were very, very, very powerful, heads of state, CEOs of major corporations, this kind of thing. So you had this mix of women who were very powerful and women who were from the very sort of bottom of the global pyramid. And it was a virtue fest. It was this exchange of goodness and empathy and everybody feeling for everybody else. But as I left this thing, I mean, the virtue of it was, I mean, it was overpowering. It was like saccharin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was too sweet. And as I left this thing, I started thinking, you know, there's somebody missing in this picture. And you know who it is? It's the American working class is just not represented at all. It's that's liberalism for you. It's these people at the very, very top, this, you know, the professional class, and these very accomplished people like Hillary Clinton and Melinda Gates was the other host. And then these people at the very, very, very bottom of world society. There's nothing said about the people in between,
mm-hmm.
you know, the women who are in the American working class and who have seen their wages stagnate, you know, and who have not done so well under the watchful eye of the Clintons and Barack Obama. So there's tons of empathy out there. There's even, I would say, a global empathy exchange, you know, with things like the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation are very much a part of this. You know, they go to Davos and there's a sort of, it's like they buy and sell virtue and goodness and empathy and righteousness. But there's one group that's always left out, and that is the American working class. This is a group that nobody feels empathy for, or nobody in liberal land, in the places where I live. If you read something like the Washington Post or the New York Times, these are people that constantly need to be corrected, that need to be, you know, scolded, you know, for not getting the message or for talking in some coarse way or for not understanding international economics or, you know, whatever it is. These are people who are the natural position of liberalism is to scold them. But there's tons of empathy out there. It's just not, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with you.
Let's go next to Alicia in Viroqua. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, folks. Thanks for talking today about this. I wanted to make a couple of comments. I'm a person who is recently energized by this movement and having a force within the Democratic Party that's actually speaking to me and speaking to the working class, speaking to people who haven't had a voice within the Democratic Party as loudly before. And as a result, I'm running for office in the 96th Assembly District in Wisconsin this year. And secondly, I'm also a pledge delegate for Bernie Sanders at the Democratic National Convention.
Mm.
And I wanted to comment that one of the things that I'm most excited about is being in that room with the amazing group of people from all across the country who worked so hard to get there, speaking for the voiceless within the Democratic Party. And we are colorful and we are genderful and we are completely wonderful.
Alicia, that sounds awesome. Thank you. That sounds awesome. I will see you there. I look forward to seeing you in Philadelphia.
You know, there are a whole lot of young people who are with her on this and with Bernie on this. Do you think they're just going to go quietly into this good night?
No, this is going to be around because this, look, inequality is not going away. This is a problem. We know why it's happening. And, you know, and we also know that I think it's obvious that Hillary Clinton is going to be president. I mean, Donald Trump, this is a, you know, well, we'll talk about that some other time. But that Hillary Clinton is going to continue the policies of the Obama administration. And look at where things are now. I mean, the labor share of gross domestic product is the lowest it has been since World War II right now. And it is stuck there, you know, and that is under this president that we are always assured is the most liberal president of all time. Inequality has gotten worse and worse and worse, and it's going to continue to get worse. And 4 years from now, you're going to have another challenge in the Democratic Party, and you're also going to have another Trump. And I'm here to tell you, you know, I think Trump is going nowhere this time around, but, you know, this is a movement. These are things that are just getting started. This anger is out there in the country. And one of the things that, you know, that I always say to this is what Listen Liberal is about. Why this is happening. I mean, why the country is so angry. I mean, it's amazing that the one establishment politician in the race, well, I guess Jeb Bush was one as well, but that she's going to be the one that, you know, that gets in there in this year of the anti-establishment uprising. But 4 years from now, there's just going to be another one. This is going to grow worse and worse and worse. And you're going to see, look, this can go either way. You can have another Bernie Sanders, a very hopeful movement. But you're also going to have another Donald Trump. You're going to have a scary side to this. But it's just going to get worse.
Alicia, thanks. Josh in Casco, hi.
Hello. I think it's not going to be a scary side. You know, I support Trump. And what if organized labor, young liberals, and everyone stand with Donald Trump because of the Hillary Clinton scandal? So if organized labor stands for Trump, what would that mean?
Well, that would be a huge change. But you know, Trump has to try. You know, if he wants organized labor to be on his side, he has to embrace some of their issues. Now, by the way, you know, Trump is not. I mean, I'm not a fan of Trump because, frankly, the bigotry and the intolerance is too much for me. I can't stand that. I can't swallow it. And I think a lot of people would agree with me on that. But what Trump has said about trade deals, he's been right about that. There are certain issues where Trump has really said some refreshing things. Now, then he'll go and contradict himself minutes later. You know, if Trump really wants to win the votes of working people and organized labor, he needs to come and address their issues and you know, drop the bigotry. And he might, you know, maybe he could change things. We'll see.
Mm. Let's look at we're coming to the end of the Obama administration, the areas that you describe his areas of virtue. What were good things? What didn't go far enough? What should have been better? And what should have been included other than taking on inequality, which is a huge issue? You mentioned Dodd-Frank, the Affordable Care Act, and the stimulus, although there were problems with the stimulus. What about Dodd-Frank? Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, well, those are his three main accomplishments as president. He, you know, he's trying to get one more before he leaves, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But, you know, Dodd-Frank is, you know, it's well, it had good intentions, and it establishes the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a really good thing. This was Elizabeth Warren's idea, remember. But Dodd-Frank is also 20,000 pages long. And it is getting longer by the minute as the you know, lobbyists and the regulators write all the different loopholes and exceptions, you know, and they're still not done with it. We don't even know. I mean, Dodd-Frank is not finished. There was a very sort of poignant, bittersweet story in the New York Times a few weeks ago where it's, you know, President Obama was personally imploring the regulators to finish Dodd-Frank, finish their work on it before he leaves office. It's so sad, you know. But no, Dodd-Frank basically, if you wanted to really regulate Wall Street and bring it to heel, it would have been pretty easy. You just overturn the deregulations of the last 20 years. You go back about, you know, to say the status quo ante of, say, I don't know, the early 1980s or something like that. It wouldn't be that hard to do. It would be painful for the banks. It would be really painful for the banks. But it would, you would restore the kind of system that we had that never, that didn't have these sort of systemic built-in problems. What they tried to do instead with Dodd-Frank was outlaw every little last detail of what went wrong. And one of my friends, who's a sort of old school bank regulator, said it was like, you know, trying to prevent another massacre by outlawing the ammunition that was used, right? You know, it's like, well, dude, the next murderer is just going to use a different weapon. You know, the banks are just going to turn to something else. So they're not going to play this game with real estate again. It'll just be something else.
And Thomas, on that note,
we
have to say goodbye because we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thomas Frank, the book is Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. His other books include What's the Matter with Kansas and Pity the Billionaire. He's also author of The Wrecking Crew. He's a former columnist for The Wall Street Journal and founding editor of The Baffler. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing and on-air producing this program, and thank you for listening and for your calls. Please join us again tomorrow. We'll talk about Britain exiting the European Union, the vote on that.